Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our guest is Zach Naylor, co-founder and CEO of Aurelius, a UX research and insights tool, and we're going to talk about making data-driven design decisions. This episode is brought to you by Yellow Images, the premium graphic assets marketplace. Get access to high-quality mockups, PNG images, creative fonts, and more to save time on your presentations. Wow your next client by heading over to yellowimages.com and snag a 20% discount using our limited-time promo code UIBREAKFAST20. Hi, Zach.
Hey, Jane. How's it going?
We are so excited to have you again on the show after all these years. And tell us, for those listeners who haven't listened to the previous one, what you do, what Aurelius does, and what you're up for this year.
Sure. So a little bit about me. My background is in UX research, product strategy. I've been doing that for a little bit more than 15 years now. I actually started my career, though, as a front-end developer and visual designer. And what I usually tell people, I was a pretty good front-end developer and an okay visual designer. And then I kind of taught myself everything I could about interaction design, UX, and research, and had started doing that. And, you know, kind of the rest is history. But at Aurelius, of course, yeah. So what we did there is we saw that there was a big gap in how you tag, analyze, search, and share all that research, especially if you're at an in-house team, a bigger company. You're doing a lot of this work and it's kind of chaotic and tools all over the place. So we decided we can build a platform that helps you do that, helps you make sense of that data, capture it, search, share, and get a lot more mileage and have impact out of that.
Aurelius, please correct me if I'm wrong. It's a piece of software. You also do content, such as you run a podcast.
Yeah.
And wasn't it a consultancy as well? So is it a pretty big brand?
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny. When we first started Aurelius, we were going to do a consultancy. And then I think very quickly what happened is the rose-colored glasses came off. You know, running a consultancy and running a SaaS business, you're essentially running two separate businesses. So we pretty quickly walked away from the consultancy type thing and focused on the software not almost exclusively. So, but you're right. Yeah, we do run a podcast and we try to put out articles that we think are interesting, people trying to solve these problems, you know, of the ever-growing popularity and topic like research ops and just analyzing research, getting more mileage out of what you do, having a bigger impact at companies you're in. Those are things that I'm personally really passionate about. So we try to write about and share. And we do have a podcast where we talk about those things, where you have been so kind enough to also join us as a guest in the past. So yeah, that's what we do.
Yeah, I recall we had a lovely conversation about, you know, the role of design in the bigger world and how to align professional expectations and stuff. And we're going to link to that in the show notes. Thanks for having me back then. As of today, before we dive into the topic, tell us what these data-driven decisions, what kind of business can they be applied to? Because if you're like day one startup, does it apply to you? If you're a consultant, does it apply to you? Or is it only for companies of certain scale?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really interesting question. I guess my answer to that would be yes, on all fronts. I think every decision is data-driven, whether or not you recognize it, right? So it's one of these things where I've actually said in the past that sometimes people say, well, we make decisions based on intuition. Well, intuition is born out of experience and data, conscious or subconscious. And so you're using something to inform that decision now, your life experience, your exposure to customers, and your observation of how they use things and what their expectations are and conversations you've had with people in the industry. All of that's actually forming your decision-making and your priority in that. I think being more mindful and intentional about that is when you make even better decisions, right? So you think about this, like this idea of a genius designer or this genius product person, like somebody like Steve Jobs, right? And they said, well, he never did research. So that's not true. He did a ton of research. He was just really good at internally distilling that and making decisions about it, right? So he didn't necessarily have an outward process for that. Not that I know everything about how he worked, but people who do that, they still are actually making data-driven decisions, right? Data-informed decisions. And I think having a very intentional, conscious process towards that help everybody do this at scale. And it doesn't really matter what size company or type of industry you're in.
what kind of what data-driven means in this context? Because we just, a couple months ago, we had Helena Ronis talk about data-driven insights, and we talked about their software that can run, you know, web analytics that can help us make decisions in marketing, and website structure, and content, especially. In your case, what is data? Is that analytics and quantitative stuff, or is it interview insights? What is it?
Yeah, that's also a very good question, and the need for clarification there always exists. So you get into this debate between quant data or qual data, and I've always said you need both. So I am not an expert in quant data, and I won't speak to that. Sounds like your other guest is, and you should probably go and listen to that episode. I'm referring mostly to qualitative data. Although I will say, you know, I have certainly done and used or married quant and qual data to make better decisions. So it definitely has its place there. I just am not the expert in quant data. So I'll talk a lot more about qual, where, you know, we're discussing things like interviews that you've done with 15, 20 people, your customers, prospective customers, or whatever the case may be. I'm talking about things like watching them using your product and taking these notes and gathering these observations about how that works and making sense of that to drive your decision-making. Now, as a quick aside, of course, I'll mention that quant data has a big part to play in that, especially at scale. So when you say if you're a bigger company and you've got the ability to use a lot of sort of objective numbers, quantitative data to show you what's happening, you can then use qualitative methods like interviews, usability testing, things like that to find out why that's happening. And that just then gives you a better picture to make, you know, as we say, a data-driven decision.
So let's say there is a decision to be made, and then you say that we do have resources at this point to make it an informed one, and we want to spend time, which is a prerequisite, because not like you're a consultant, you're going to snap your finger and suddenly the resources are there for you to run the research. Let's imagine the resources are there. How do you decide what kind of research we need to inform that?
Sure. That's highly contextual. It's going to depend on, let's see, it's going to depend on the maturity of your product or service or company. It's going to depend on who you have access to and how readily available you can get access to them. And what I mean by that is, you know, is this a general consumer app and it's, you know, kind of segregations of people that are, you know, large populations you can get access to? Or are these highly specified, highly skilled people who their time is extremely valuable and we don't have a list of folks to reach out to? That's going to be a lot harder to find too, right? So I think you need to first take a look at those two things, because the maturity of your company and your product or service is going to really dictate what it is you need to learn. In one case, you might be trying to learn how to make that thing better. In another case, very early startup or company, you might be trying to determine if this thing is valuable. And so the, you know, the methods or approach there are going to be very different. But in any case, once you have those, then it makes it a little bit easier to decide which method or approach or way you're going to get this information to make a decision. It makes that decision easier. But, you know, I love the old standby of interviews. Honestly, just get out and talk to people. And how strict or rigorous you are in the planning and setting up and recruiting of that, I think, again, is based on your maturity. But I'm of the mind where I believe talking with people and getting some information is better than none and going off of intuition. So if you have no other opportunity than to just simply interview and chat with people, even online like this, then you're going to get a lot more that will help you in making a decision or taking a direction than if you wouldn't have otherwise.
I recall we had an episode here ages ago about research panels. And that means that you will have a small number of very loyal customers who will be happy to test stuff with you, do interviews with you. So that's one of the things I can recommend. If that will save your time recruiting people for every decision, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Have you done anything like that in your practice?
Yeah, I have. I mean, in previous jobs, right? So before starting our own SaaS company with Aurelius, where we're serving research teams, I obviously worked in that capacity at various levels, all the way from individual contributor to director and whatnot. But those are important and obviously really, really helpful. This is a big part of research ops too, when I refer to that term and kind of what's getting discussed there. And, you know, it can be comprised of people who are your existing customers that you reach out to and do research with. It can be a pool of people who meet the population or behavioral set that may be your customers or are potential customers too, you know, so, and it could be a combination of both. Those things are really helpful. Are they necessary in every case? No. But again, depending on the maturity of your company, tending to be larger companies, it sure makes research go a lot faster because recruiting and scheduling is a big operational nightmare, which is why research ops is such a big deal.
Give us a brief overview of those common methods that you mentioned, which is interviews and also usability testing, and what are the cons and pros of each?
Yeah. So I don't know that I would look at it in terms of pros and cons for each. I think it's more, you know, appropriateness for when you do each one. So interviews for me are almost universally appropriate. Now, you know, where things start to really separate is usability testing is putting something in front of someone and seeing how they use that. I'm intentionally being vague because it can be applied in all these different ways. And there's all these sort of sub methods to usability testing and how you approach that, right? Where you can be very open-ended and freeform. You can be very directed and task-based. You can do usability testing on competitors' products. You can do usability testing on yours. You can do usability testing on prototypes. Like, there's all these different ways that you can do that to glean different information, right? So, but for me, the departure between those two, or the more appropriate application, of course, is usability testing is you're looking to learn how someone uses a thing. And that's because you're trying to make a decision either about that thing or maybe a competing thing, if that makes sense. Now, interviews are sort of a lot broader, where they're just conversations that tend to have a specific goal on your end, right? You're looking to learn from people about X, Y, or Z. And so you're going to schedule conversations, again, can be intentionally open-ended within boundaries, or they can be very specific and kind of task-based. But the part that you're going to be missing there is actually observing how someone uses a product or service.
We had a great episode with Ali Blum just a couple of weeks ago, where we talked like in great detail about running interviews. I would love to hear what kind of insights we're looking for in both interviews and testing that we can use, because we never really covered the outcomes of like how we analyze the interviews and how we make decisions based on that. And I would love to focus more on that decision-making point.
Sure. Well, for me, that actually starts well before any of the research gets conducted. So for me, that actually starts with creating and setting really clearly defined goals, both for the product and the experience, as well as the business goals. And, you know, many times they can go hand in hand. They may be one and the same. But that starts with understanding, what is it that we need to learn? What is it that we're trying to do in the business? For me, creating those goals actually has three parts. There's a goal statement. There are success indicators. And then there's metrics for that. Okay. We can talk about each one. By the way, I do interviews with stakeholders to set these up. This is exactly how I worked when I was still, you know, working as a practitioner or a leader in the space. And so this is talking with stakeholders, product owners, whoever it might be. And you're breaking those three parts down. The goal statement is saying something like, we want to make this easier to use, or we want to encourage more people to sign up for a free trial, right? Now, that goal statement is fine, but it doesn't quite give you enough to act on or even directionally say, what kind of research are we going to do, or what questions do we need answered? So that's where the success indicators come in. This is the actual behavior and indicators that we're meeting that goal. So when I get a statement like that, or I get an answer, hey, what are we trying to do? Okay, we want more people to sign up for the free trial. Great. I then ask, what sort of things are we going to see, hear, feel if we're meeting that goal? And so then what we're going to get are answers that are behavior-based. Now, this is right in our wheelhouse as UX and UX research people, right? We're all about behavior, observing it, trying to understand it, designing for it. So now you're going to get things where that answer is going to say, oh, well, you know, we'll probably see more people coming to the free trial sign up, asking us questions about that, signing up and trying it out. Great. That's all behavior. Now, the third piece to that goal are the metrics. That's easy now. How do you measure that behavior? Well, we can say we're going to measure how many trials we get over the next, you know, X time period. We can measure how many visits we get to that page. We can measure how many questions we get about a free trial, you know, from customer support. There's all these different ways. Now, why this matters to me in breaking down that goal, the goals in that way, is because a goal statement is too vague. It's not concrete enough, and it doesn't give us enough confidence and direction. Sometimes we start with just the metrics too. Oh, we want to increase free trial sign up. The problem there is it's so specific that there's actually three or four different ways I could probably move that metric for you. And some of them might not even be ethical, right? Like we can buy traffic to the site and go, look, we did a great job on this project. The traffic went up, but it didn't do anything for your business because we didn't actually see the goal get met. So that middle piece, the success indicators, which is very focused on behavior, is what matters most to me, particularly as a UX researcher. So let's go back to the original question. How do you do research then where you can analyze that and actually start to make, you know, actionable outcomes off of it? Well, I take those success indicators and that's where you start your research plan. You start asking questions like, okay, what do we need to know to encourage more people to come to the trial signup page? What do we know about what questions are getting asked about the trial in customer support today? Now, all of a sudden, that's also even giving you an idea of method. Well, we should do interviews or maybe run a survey with our customer support team and see what kind of information we're getting there. So you see where I'm going with this, right? You structure your research and the goals of your research, and then you choose the methods that help you answer questions for the behavior you're looking to design for. Now, we can spend another podcast or two talking about how you execute that research and analyze it, right? But again, you have those goal statements really well defined. You can start looking at that data and saying, are we answering that question? And if you have, then the outcomes become pretty straightforward as you start making recommendations that very, you know, clearly meet some of those outcomes. And I have a way I actually break down how to share those as well.
We would love to hear a story or some examples of how that was done in practice, because of course you can say a lot, but then when it sure comes to real life, things are much harder than just nominal goal. What is it in real life?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the stories that comes to mind is I was working with a team that I had just joined. I don't think I'd been there more than a month or two, honestly. And I joined a team. One of the designers who was working on this mobile app, which was one of my first projects, had been there a very long time. Awesome designer. They were an awesome designer, but the challenge they were having is, you know, the executive leader of that product, the director of that product, they weren't really taking the team's recommendations. And, you know, what had happened was they said, we want to redesign the home screen of the app, right? So they had asked this designer and the team, design us some options for a new home screen. And that's what we want to change. Now, the problem was nobody talk to them and understand why they wanted a new home screen. They just said that that's what they wanted. And they had, you know, for a long time gotten in this design cycle of take the request, do it, kind of give, you know, give the team what they were requesting. And when I had joined, I said, I don't think they want a new home screen. I think they need to redesign the entire navigation of the app. And of course, everybody looked at me like I was crazy because I was the new guy. I'd only been there a couple months. And this was my first project on this mobile app with that team. And I said, well, look, we're just going to try it my way. If I'm wrong, I'll be the first one to admit it. But if not, then we actually get to do better work and have a bigger impact on this, right? So the first thing I did was have conversations with those stakeholders. And I asked them the same questions that I just talked about. As I said, you know, what's the business goal of the mobile app? Why do we have a mobile app? If your boss is looking at your success, how do they know whether or not the mobile app is successful? And I took a lot of notes about this and I distilled it down into a handful of goals. Now, I will tell you that we had one design meeting with the stakeholders. So this was the VP of marketing and the director of the mobile app. In that meeting, prior to me having these conversations, they literally drew what they wanted on a piece of paper and handed it to the designer and said, just do that. Now, that doesn't sound like a very fun role to have as a designer, right? Probably makes a lot of people cringe. They might have been in similar situations. Well, the very next meeting, we literally presented a handful of suggestions, big changes for the app. And not a single one was contested. Now, do you know what changed between those two meetings? Is I talked with those stakeholders, set these goals, we all agreed on them, and then every recommendation or suggestion we provided in the next meeting clearly showed why we should do this and how it would help us meet one of those goals. Because we were then speaking their language, right? And so then the way I present these recommendations, it's basically like Mad Lib style. I say, I think we should insert your idea or recommendation. Because supporting evidence, here's the thing we learned from research. And also because it will help us meet, you know, X, Y, or Z goal. It's literally like a plug and play formula. You can talk about it however you want. You don't need to use the same language I do. But the idea here is that sometimes when people say design doesn't get a seat at the table, or they throw their hands up and they get frustrated and say, they don't get it. They don't get design. They don't get the value of our work. That's not true. It's not their job to understand design. It's your job to help them see the value you provide to the business. And all we're doing by setting these goals up really well is creating a common language for us all to speak to, where everybody's on the same page as to why these changes or these suggestions or these recommendations matter and how it will actually help the entire business, not just the design.
This is amazing. This has also helped me a ton in my consulting practice when I was brought a certain assignment, and then it really helps to zoom out and ask for business goals, what they're trying to achieve, etc. But sometimes I've had occasions when it doesn't work as well. And especially that I did, for example, my consulting review with those goals and everything. And we're like, wow, this has really elevated our whole project. This is like exactly like this girl is brilliant. And then nothing happens and they just keep going and dictating decisions. So are there any tips on how to like carry on with this if it seems that the parties just don't get each other?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, why it's so important to establish these goals in this level of detail that I suggest at the beginning is because exactly when that happens, right? So projects are often not just a couple weeks. Sometimes these things are months or even a year, right? Or year, a couple years, depending on where you work and what you do. A lot happens in between the space of when you started the project and then. And these goals are a way to keep everybody reminded and top of mind of what exactly we're trying to achieve. Because we start to chase different things based on the challenge of the project or the context that we're working in at that time. So yes, a couple tips or suggestions I have. The first one is, if we start to see decisions getting made or direction changing that aren't in line with that, we now have something concrete to fall back on. Rather than say, I disagree with your opinion, because opinions, they're too subjective. And then it's me versus you. And then it removes that argument. We say, are we making decisions that help us meet this goal? It brings everybody back and gets them grounded and say, okay, you're right. We should step back. Maybe we're taking the wrong decision. Or, and this is the alternative, you say, have our goals changed? Because then you can have a constructive conversation about that. Maybe the direction should change because the goals and the needs of the project have changed. But then you have the opportunity to talk about that, adjust the goals, you know, sort of redefine them and move forward together in consensus rather than I disagree with you. I think you're wrong. My opinion, your opinion. And that's never going to lead to a successful project.
Let's talk a little bit about capturing insights that you can get from research and making them all edible for everyone. Because, for example, in my company, UserList, we're a small team and I can do research and then I can like make my own conclusions and such. But there's got to be a way to do this collaboratively, because there is breakdown between multiple people who want to parse them as well and make their own conclusions, etc. And of course, one of the challenges is removing your bias from that as you're putting them down. But what is the format, how insights exist in real world? What are these? Sentiments, Trello cards, or I don't know, Aurelius cards? Don't go too hard pitching your product, but that's an angle we can tackle.
Sure. Well, it's definitely one of the big things that we try and capture and help you with in Aureli. So insights are probably the most important thing we do in our work, right? So as UX people, as researchers, sharing findings and these nuggets or insights from research to help people make decisions is one of the most important things we do. What those are made up of for me, again, very similar to a goal. It's a statement of a thing we learned, maybe an additional description and some more detail around that, right? And then there are actual data, facts, observations, quotes, notes, you know, details that back that up. So it's one thing to say, here's what we learned. It's another to say, here are the data that sort of backs it up and shows how we arrive there. So think back to third grade math class, where they say, show your work. You can't just give the right answer. They want to see how you arrive there. And so having that sort of data be, you know, behind that and attached to it so people can reference it, understand the context, see how you arrive there, really helps them sort of, as you say, make it more editable for the insight to understand how you arrived there and why this is something important to learn. Of course, the other big piece to that is then saying, using those insights and linking it to those recommendations you make. Of course, I'm using actual language in Aurelius, you know, so you can say, here's a thing we think we should do. Here's the insights that back that up. Here's all the data that drove the insight. So it's very traceable And that's honestly one of the big reasons why we do what we do, because we've seen that problem. So, you know, those things all kind of combined help somebody get the picture in a digestible way of how they're linked and why it matters.
What does an insight look like in Aurelius from the, I don't know, taxonomy data structure point of view? Is it just like a written sentence, or does it have structure to it?
Yeah. So, well, in Aurelius specifically, you know, with insights, there's a lot you can do. So there's the name of the insight. So the actual statement, the sentence, whatever it might be, you can add a description to that, talking about, you know, what that means. Because it's one thing to say, we found people find the signup form very confusing. Okay, but then you can add a description to that, right? Then you can actually take your research notes and even documents, so pictures, recordings, interviews, whatever, and attach all that to the insight. Now, because it's software, we do a whole lot more to help you get more out of the insights. You can tag them, which means you'll be able to, you know, find them by tags, which might be certain themes or topics or products and things like that. You can attach comments to the insight just like you would if you're presenting it. And we also have some interesting stuff on there where you can add a priority and a type to the insights. You can filter off of those. You can see all the high priority insights. You can see all the design or feature related insights. So it's multifaceted in Aurelius, but, you know, at the heart of it, again, it's that statement of what you learned, your additional detail about that, and more importantly, the evidence or, you know, observations and data and quotes and stuff that you can attach so people see how you got there.
Let's talk about one use case of taking a decision. And most common one is like what we should be building next. And it's not like a very specific question, but it's a challenge that the product owner faces every day, basically. Not every day, maybe every sprint. Mm-hmm. And you don't have like dedicated research rounds for every sprint. How do you, in your own product, prioritize new features, and how do you recommend others to do that?
Well, those are going to be two different things because, you know, we're a startup still and we're pretty small. I can talk about how I do it for sure. And then I can talk about how I've done it for companies and recommended it for companies. For me, you know, we have a big advantage because we're a small team. We can move really quickly. I am the co-founder, but also the owner of the product. So there's not a whole lot of consensus I need to build other than maybe with my co-founder. But, you know, I can tell you what the big deal here is we think about what we're trying to achieve with our business, not just the product. Yes, our product essentially is the business, but there's a lot more, as you know, that goes on with a business. So are we trying to grow? Are we trying to become more stable? Are we trying to expand into another area? Whatever the case may be. So there's this high level business goal, right? And then there's also what the product needs to do to meet that business goal. And so that in combination with things we're hearing either from our current customers or other places in the market we may or may not want to grow into, help me prioritize the things, you know, that we work on next and that we build next. Of course, as with all product management activities, there's the balance of time, money, and resources, right? So if this is something that we think is going to have a huge impact to that business goal in really low effort, that's a no-brainer. We prioritize that higher. If it's a huge lift, a lot of effort and not a very big impact, that falls a little farther down on the roadmap. Of course, customer feedback drives a huge prioritization factor in our company. Right now, we're 100% self-funded, independently owned. And so everything we do is based on what we hear from our customers. So that's a big factor too. Now, when you're in a larger company, that's a lot harder because you're typically working on bigger products, maybe multiple products that kind of have to work together. Again, though, it starts with one larger business goal. Like what's the business trying to achieve this quarter or this year? And so what's the strategy towards stepping there? And you have to take a look at what your product can do as part of helping meet that goal, right? You have to look at what you might be doing that's complementary to another feature or another product in your company to help meet that goal. So that's unfortunately really, really dependent on the situation you're in. But for me, again, all good product decisions or all good product strategy, they're just a set of really informed decisions, both by clearly defined goals of your business and your product and something you've learned from customers that help give you more specific detail on how to act on that.
One approach that we adopted a year ago at UserList that was hugely helpful was our own flavor of the shape-up method from 37 Signals. Basically, the way they recommend to run your roadmap is to basically kill it. So their philosophy is that the resources are always limited and the situation changes all the time. every week. And by the beginning of the next iteration, things are going to be different either way. So why waste all that effort on prioritizing something that will always change? Therefore, we kind of abandoned long-term prioritization and just go for like short-term decisions, what matters the most at the moment. And that's been quite a relief, I should say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very worth trying for everybody.
Absolutely. I'm actually really glad you brought up, 37 Signals. Well, now Basecamp, I guess, technically. When people have, our customers and even other folks who know us, they've actually compared us to them. Now, I don't think that's a fair comparison. They are far more successful.
Nice,
I think they mean that in terms of our product philosophy. We are completely in agreement with that. I have, I've never thought of it as we're copying that approach, but it sure sounds like we are. And you're right. I mean, I usually tell people too. So when I used to do a lot of work in product strategy, I would tell people planning anything beyond 3 months is a complete fiction. It's just in the world that we live in our industry, again, most of us are working in technology, software, things are going to change way too quickly. Even things that you don't anticipate to change. So outside factors that we have no control over. So yes, exactly to your point, why spend the time and effort planning for that when it's never going to come to fruition? What I like to do is it sounds a lot like what you're doing at UserList is say, okay, here's what we're doing, this week, next week. Here's the vision of where we're looking to head. So are we making decisions that are going to lead us in that direction? Cool. We have a backlog of that. We can make any of those decisions based on the priority at the moment, or we can change based on how other things change or our customers' needs change. And that happens all the time. And honestly, it's one of the things we take the most pride in because our customers tell us, hey, we're always really satisfied with how quickly you react to our feedback and not just taking the feedback, but like we see it change in the product because you have to be that way. At the end of the day, we're not successful if they aren't successful. So you're sticking to some plan that we put stubbornly, 6 months in advance, just because we said we planned it, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. We need to meet customer needs. And so that's what we focus on the most.
How do you take negative decisions? Like we're not building this feature. Like we're not building it anytime soon, ever. Like we're not doing that as a product. That's always tough. Like I've really, really practiced, like strengthened that muscle over the last few years, like being able to say no, mm-hmm. but in a reasonable fashion. It's something you do a lot as a founder.
Yeah.
So what are your recommendations about that?
Sure. So just to be clear, you're asking how do you go about that if you're a founder or a product owner and maybe you're talking to a customer?
Yep. But also as a consultant, I guess. It's an interesting flavor.
Sure. Okay. Well, I would actually handle that approach a little differently as a consultant. I can talk about that. As a founder, it is difficult because you don't like to say no to people. You want to be able to say, we'll build everything you want. We just want to make you happy because we're so grateful that you're customers of ours and we're passionate about this or whatever the case may be. It's funny you ask because I just had that situation in a meeting right before we jumped on this podcast. Somebody asked us about particular feature set, actually. It's pretty complicated stuff that we've heard before. And the way I answered them is I said, that's right. And it would make a ton of sense for us to do an Aurelius. We've decided not to do it. It's really complex. There's a lot of legal challenges, interestingly, with this thing they were asking about. And I said, I gotta be honest with you, there's other tools that do that better. We're interested in integrating with them and we will look at that, but we don't have that capability right now. And we believe we should focus on what we do best because that's what's going to be in your best interest. So that's how I typically handle those situations. Now, if it is something that comes up that we maybe hadn't heard of and have not considered at all, and I say, we'll take that and look at it. That might make sense. But I just try to be really honest and straightforward. And I find that goes a long way, rather than trying to say like, oh, no, we don't. But like we might, maybe we'll build that. I don't want to lead somebody on. I prefer to be very straightforward. Say, hey, that's not what we do. That's not what Aurelius is good for. Here's where we can help you the most. And we try to double down on that. Very much like Basecamp, right? Like they killed all their products and they said, Basecamp's the thing. This is what we do good. This is how we want to help you. We try to take that philosophy too. Now, as a consultant, to say, we're not doing that feature, we're not doing this product, I think you need to tread really carefully based on your relationship and the role and expectation, right? Because in some cases, we don't necessarily, and I've been in that situation for sure. In some cases, you haven't built the trust to deliver that kind of message. In some cases, the expectation is not that you're giving that kind of concrete recommendation where they say, you don't own that decision. You don't get to tell me. So I think examining the place that you have in that consulting relationship is first. And then second is, again, I would go back to saying, assuming you've done the hard work of establishing good goals for the product, the business, the project, and then you've done research that backs it up, you can say, hey, look, I don't make that recommendation. I don't support that recommendation. And here's why. It doesn't meet what we learned from customers, your customers. It doesn't help us meet the goal that you agreed to, that you're, you know, quite frankly, we got from you. So I'm happy to discuss it more if you think I'm missing something or if you feel like the goals have changed. Again, it allows us to have a conversation where it's not me saying you're wrong. It's saying, are we together doing the thing that we set out to do? And you can have a lot more constructive conversation about that.
By the way, we've had an episode about workshops not so long ago that I'm going to link to. And workshops are a wonderful way to extract goals and insights from the stakeholders without having them, because they can do the homework, they're busy. So the only way to get them on your, like, do what you want is get them in real time and try to do something with them real time as a workshop. That's why I think the design sprint and everything like that has been so effective, because you get everybody to do stuff in real time.
Yeah, I love workshops. I love UX design research workshops. When I used to work at a place called The Nerdery, it was a consultancy. Funny enough, that's actually where I met my co-founder. And he and I had done a lot of work together where I was running workshops with stakeholders of these bigger clients we were working on to do exactly what you described. Yeah, it's a great method to do that. And that is its own art in and of itself. And there's so many ways you can approach that too. Design sprint is just one of them.
I would also like to mention that when you say no to a client as a consultant, yes, you might feel that you know better, but even if you did the drill, it still might be that you don't have the full picture. And like, you should be more humble. Like, everybody out there listening to us, just imagine that you don't know everything. And it seems like you're coming in and you're like, oh, I see the navigation is wrong, but it's like the Chesterton fence, you know, you don't know the story behind that. You don't know how it got there. You don't know what was before, mm-hmm. and the reasoning and none of that. And even if you do the drill like you recommended, that increases the chance of understanding well, but you still probably have no idea of the historical like situation. So
absolutely.
Everyone be more humble there.
No, absolutely. I think that's such a great point, because I got a lot of friends who still work in the consultant end of things. And you know, while I have a big part of my past career in that world, I've been traditionally kind of an in-house guy. And that's why I've always preferred it, because you have all the context and nuance that you just can't get as a consultant. Frankly, it's in some cases too expensive to, you know, to get that person that kind of context, right? And so, yeah, totally. Be more humble, but then also be willing to say, there's probably more I don't know here. It's kind of like, for all the parents out there, somebody telling you how to parent your own children. It's like, you don't know my kids. You might be an expert in parenting, but you don't know my kids and my situation. You know, and so people can take offense to that, right? Like, just like you would someone telling you how to raise your own kids.
Yeah, with the kids, it's like, oh my goodness, another year, we made it through. Like, not sure how, but you know, things are still fine. Well, I guess with the products, it's a little bit like that.
I'm saying, funny enough, business is not all that much different than that. We have a plan where here's all the things we're going to do. And then we get T-boned by chaos or a pandemic or whatever the case may be. And we do the best we can with what we have.
You know, there is one dramatic difference, though, because kids, they're like default alive and growing. Mm. Businesses, not default growing. Mm-hmm. Like, you've got to kick hard to make them grow. So it's a little bit different.
Yeah, for sure.
So as we're closing up this episode, are there any thought leaders out there that have inspired your product journey that relate to today's topic? Maybe blogs, podcasts, anything like that, authors?
Well, yeah, you already mentioned the folks over at Basecamp, formerly 37 Signals. I mean, before I ever started Aurelius, I read a lot of what they had to say, and I had a tremendous amount of respect for that, because, you know, it's really hard to be that honest with yourself, especially when, I mean, they have accomplished everything that they had, even with multiple products and doing things differently. It shows a lot of maturity and I think wisdom to make those hard choices to reduce, right, the amount of things that you do and what you focus on. So that's a great one. And they run a podcast and stuff that I think talks about that at a higher level context in terms of business, not just design. There are so many design and UX and research people. I will not mention any names because I know that I'll leave people out, and how many people who have contributed to my inspiration and my knowledge over the years. But, you know, just jump on Twitter, search for people. You're going to find them. They're everywhere. They're really great.
You know, when it comes to design inspiration, it's almost like I don't go search for design inspiration anymore. But every time I do, it's on the verge of being depressed at how awesome other people are. It's like the web is so full of amazing designers. I just don't know what I'm doing here. Like, seriously, especially the visual part, it's amazing. You don't always get the business background behind that, but the visuals, oh my God.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of extremely impressive visual designers for sure. The interesting thing there, though, you know, I will share a quote with you that's always inspired me and has been kind of a guiding principle in my personal life and professional or design life is, you know, just because I can doesn't mean I should. And that's something that's really important to me. And it actually ties into what you're saying. Like, this might be a really beautiful design. We had somebody on our podcast recently. And what they'd said was, you know, a design fails if it doesn't ship. And so if you think about what that means,
right,
it can actually still be beautiful and brilliant, but it sucks for the business, or we can't support it, or the technology effort is too high for the cost. And, you know, so that context matters. And just because I can doesn't mean I should. You know, there's a lot of tools in our toolbox now more than ever as designers and researchers. And I think why I mentioned, you know, the folks at Basecamp, DHA, Jason, they've always been really good and humble about that, saying there's a lot of cool stuff we can do, but that's not what's right for our customers, for us as a business, and for our product.
Thanks so much for this inspiring idea to finish up this episode. Where can people find you and your product online?
Yeah, so I am pretty easy to find. I'm on Twitter, Zach Naylor, ZACKNAYLOR. I do my best to answer every chat that we've actually got on our website. So you can check us out there. And that's where you can find Aurelius. That's AureliusLab.com. So AureliusLab.com. Or just search for Aurelius UX. And we're probably going to be the first one that pops up. But yeah, feel free to reach out to me either one of those ways. I'm fairly easy to find.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much for sharing your wisdom today. And good luck with growing your tool and exposing it to even more UX designers.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you having me. It was fun.
Wonderful. Have a great rest of your week.
All right. See you.